And now it's time for Power of Prophecy, continuing the legacy of Tex Mars, exposing evil, and promoting Jesus Christ as Savior. Here's your host, Jerry Barrett.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. I'm your host, Jerry Barrett, honored to have you join me again this week. This week, we are going to conclude our discussion on terrorism in America, All Roads Lead to Israel. My guest is Pat McShay. Pat, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Jerry.
Now, can you give us a synopsis of what we covered in the first half, part one of this program set?
Yeah, I sure can. You know, we talked in the first hour how a large number of Israeli firsters, including neocon Zionists in America and a number of prominent Israelis, were planning regime change and war to steal land and murder the indigenous people in seven Middle Eastern countries, starting with Iraq. And at least five of them, including Bibi Netanyahu, in the 20 years before 9/11, talked about the need for a new Pearl Harbor-type attack and the destruction of the Twin Towers in New York, which would eventually later be blamed on radical Muslim terrorists. Many of these same men, as members of Bush's administration, 5 years later, would get their new Pearl Harbor-type event in what I believe was a false flag attack on 9/11. They would blame Muslim terrorists, and they'd get their war. But with zero evidence against bin Laden and his terrorists, they were convicted by the American media, who were complicit with this un-American agenda. That's the story that was presented to the American people. All false, by the way.
Right. Anybody who has taking the time to dig into this subject, and obviously you have with your article, there is a link to Pat's article at powerofprophecy.com under the news of the day. You can look it up there. Pat, there is loads of evidence that the American people have never seen that proves that this was a cover-up by our government. It's funny how this happens in these major crisis events, Pat. There seem to be the man on the street interviews have crisis actors at almost all of these, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Matter of fact, I was talking to someone earlier about the Charlie Kirk shooting. The older guy that was yelling, shoot me, at the Charlie Kirk shooting, turns out that he was also at 9/11 in New York on 9/11, and he was also at the Boston bombing, and the odds of that are, you know, like a zillion to one. There was a guy they called the Harley Davidson man that they talked to on 9/11 in New York, and they asked him, you know, hey, what do you think? And he gave this long, rambling answer talking about how the structure of the building just couldn't handle the violent explosion by the plane's impact, and goes into all this detail. And I immediately thought, this guy sounds like an actor. He sounds like somebody that they brought in to give this ridiculous explanation. He even said that the plane went into the building and came out the other side, which I thought at the time and still do was impossible. Well, and it turned out that the guy was a member of the Screen Actors Guild and had done work for Fox News in the past. So they have these people at all these events. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because the average American person, and Mark Dice has done this on his podcast, He has taken to the streets with a camera and a microphone, asking basic questions about this country to young people, to older people. And the answers they come up with are so idiotic and out in left field that they don't know anything. So the odds.
They don't know any history at all.
No. And the odds of this guy being in New York City to be street interviewed and have that kind of response is almost like the guy being in Boston for the Marathon Massacre and 9/11 and Charlie Kirk shooting. Zillions to one.
Yeah. I linked the video in my article to the Harley Davidson guy. And they call him that because he has a Harley Davidson t-shirt on.
Well, they got to make him look like Americana. That's why they had to dress him up. So I'm sure he was in New York a week before and they were practicing all this and correcting the script.
Well, that's something I did not put in my article. You just reminded me is FEMA was in had a team in New York the day before 9/11. Just more prior knowledge there.
Right. Controlled media refuses to admit that there were bombs inside the Twin Towers, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And all of the firemen, all of the workers, even the people on the street that day heard hundreds of bombs going off. William Rodriguez was a building maintenance worker in the North Tower where he'd worked for 20 years. And he was thrown to the ground by a huge violent explosion. And he was in the basement, in one of the sub-basements. First of all, that directly contradicts the official account because that explosion happened before the plane ever hit the North Tower. He testified to the 9/11 commission about those bombs going off in the building, and none of that was mentioned in the 9/11 report. Same thing with all of the firemen that testified about the bombs going off all through the buildings, none of their testimony was included.
Rodriguez had been employed at the Twin Towers for over 20 years, so he had an intimate knowledge of this building, didn't he?
Yeah, he was called the last man out. He had a key and was helping firemen open locked doors, locked stairwells to help people get out. He was credited with saving a lot of lives that day. He said later that no one in all the interviews he did wanted to talk about the bombs in the building. So he was told not to talk about it.
Well, they've already got their man on the street that is an expert in engineering and structural engineering.
Right.
Now, another thing that you covered in your report was British intelligence reported that the Mossad ran these Arab cells.
Yeah, British intelligence reported just 3 months after 9/11 that the Israeli Mossad ran Arab hijacker cells that would be blamed by the 9/11 commission. The hijackers were CIA recruits. They were allowed into the United States. At least two of the hijackers they know of were recruited into a joint CIA-Saudi Arabian intelligence operation that was covered up at the highest levels, according to, you know, new court filings. The CIA and the Israeli Mossad had all these hijackers under surveillance. So they not only allowed them into the United States, these hijackers, many of them were living on American air bases. The hijackers in Florida, including Mohammed Atta, were also under surveillance by an Israeli Mossad team that lived right down the street from where they were living. Mohammed Atta was living with a stripper. She said that they spent their nights partying, drinking heavily, and doing cocaine. How many jihadis who are getting ready to give their life for Allah are going to be drinking? These guys don't drink. They don't party with strippers and do cocaine. And they were also seen gambling on a boat, a gambling boat owned by Jack Abramoff, who was considered a super lobbyist who bragged that he had 100 congressmen in his pocket and would later go on to be arrested for corruption. So these hijackers were well connected and very well known by our American CIA and the Israeli Mossad.
And when you factor in who ran the security at these airports where these airplanes allegedly were hijacked from, I mean, who ran the security there, Pat?
The security was run by a company called Securicom, and on the board of directors was Wirt Walker, who was the head of the company. On the board of directors also was Marvin Bush, who was George Bush's younger brother. And not only that, before 9/11, the company that had the security for the Twin Towers was a company that was owned by a former Israeli Mossad operative. Israel's fingerprints are just all over the 9/11 attacks. And not only that, they did the security for all four airports involved in 9/11, and they were also in charge of the airports that allowed the shoe bomber, Richard Reed, and the underwear bomber onto the airplanes, even though they didn't have proper ID, and they were both false flags. That's the reason that people today have to have these invasive crotch searches and have to take their shoes off at the airport. These were just because of Israeli false flags. The company was called ICTS. It was owned by Menachem Atzman and Ezra Harrell, who were both former Israeli intelligence officers. And the personnel that they hired at the company were mostly Israeli Shin Bet intelligence officers.
So when you start connecting the dots, Pat, we've got Israelis in charge of security for the Twin Tower, Israelis in charge of the airports where these planes took off and got hijacked. They ran security at the airport for the shoe bomber, the underwear bomber. They had Israeli undercover Mossad operatives keeping surveillance on these Arabs. I want to put Arabs in air quotes, because were they really, or were they IDF or Mossad operatives that did some of this? I mean, the pieces are too coincidental to be anything other than a massive operation between the Mossad, the CIA, and our federal government to usurp our liberties.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty common when you look into Israeli intelligence, it's pretty common for them to use Arab Jews. So just 5 days before 9/11, here's another, a disproportionate amount of put options were bought on United Airlines and American Airlines. Now, a put option is placed on stocks whose future value is thought to be headed for an immediate decline. And the company that placed the orders was a company called A.B. Brown, who has connections to Deutsche Bank. The International Organization of Security Commissions stated that it was the largest inside trading ever committed, and profits were in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The UK's independent newspaper reported just a month later that, to the embarrassment of investigators, it has emerged that the firm used to buy the put options was a company that was headed by a guy named A.B. Buzzy Krongard, Buzzy the nickname. Buzz Krongard had connections. He was Jewish. had many ties to Israel. And on 9/11, he was the executive director of the CIA. So we already know that the CIA and the Mossad had prior knowledge of 9/11. So they made hundreds of millions of dollars based on prior knowledge of the attack. And, you know, like I said, many of the 9/11 hijackers trained on military, U.S. military base. So it sounds like everybody knew in the military and the intelligence communities. And just before 9/11, an extremely organized Israeli spy ring and phone tapping operation was found to be operating in the U.S. and hundreds of Israelis, some of them with backgrounds in military intelligence, and still others who were still active duty in the Israeli military and had and were explosive specialists. So they targeted military bases and other sensitive locations. And when they were found out, they just sent them back to Israel. Nobody got in trouble. And like I said, it was found out that many of these guys lived in Hollywood, Florida. One of them, a guy named Hanan Sarfati, who was a military intelligence officer for Israel, lived right down the street from the Florida hijackers, including Mohammed Atta. So he was on the surveillance team who was monitoring the Florida hijackers. So none of this was a surprise. Carl Cameron, I think we talked about, did that four-part series from Fox News about the Israeli spy ring. And he asked, when he asked about links to 9/11 with these Israelis, the reply was, evidence linking these Israelis to 9/11 is classified. I cannot tell you about evidence that's been gathered. They were obviously involved. They obviously had prior knowledge. Investigators within the DEA, the FBI, the INS, all told Fox News that to pursue or even suggest that Israel was spying on America was considered career suicide. And an FBI agent later, when he was asked why Osama bin Laden was not on their most wanted page, Rex Toombs, the FBI agent, replied that because the FBI has no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. The truth is, they had no hard evidence and still don't that any of the so-called hijackers had anything to do with 9/11.
Isn't that convenient? That's...
Get this, Zim International Navigational was the world's ninth largest shipping firm in the world, and they had their headquarters in the World Trade Center, except a week before 9/11, they broke their long-term lease, which I think had 10 years to go on the lease. They had to pay a $50,000 fee to break their lease, and suddenly vacated their office a week before 9/11. So there you've got more evidence of prior knowledge. Larry Silverstein had a meeting on the morning of 9/11 in the Windows on the World, the restaurant at the top of the North Tower. He said that he forgot that he had a dermatologist appointment to go to, so he had to skip his meeting, and it saved his life.
Yeah, how convenient.
I don't believe a thing Larry Silverstein said.
Right. And then you find out Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, among other sleazy things connected with Kamala Harris.
Yeah, he was Kamala's sugar daddy, and he was warned not to fly to New York around the date of 9/11. And not only that, the Bush family had a decades-long business and personal relationship with the bin Laden family, and Bush allowed those family members to fly out of the U.S. after Americans were told they weren't allowed to fly. Not only was George H.W. Bush a business partner of Osama's brother, Salem bin Laden, since 1978, in a company called Arbusto Energy in Texas, he also had a meeting that morning, a breakfast meeting, with Shafiq bin Laden, another one of Osama's brothers. So you know that there was some prior knowledge going on there. And in Bibi Netanyahu's book in 1995, he predicted that Americans needed to wake up to the suicidal nature of the Islamic jihadists. And he said that the next thing you'll see is militant Islamists bringing down the World Trade Center. He said that 6 years before 9/11.
You know, you recommended that I talk to Susan Lindauer. She was a high-level asset with the CIA, and I did interview Susan. Tremendous program with her. I know that to this day, she is still, it's a gut punch that she knew what was coming and nobody would listen, nobody would do anything because of this massive cover-up.
Yeah, Susan, I read her book a while back, and she was briefed by her CIA handler in May of 2001. So 4 months before 9/11, she knew, she tried to talk to people, and people just acted like she was crazy. And her cousin, she tried to get a meeting with Andy Card, who was a Bush advisor. He was the guy that whispered into Bush's ear in the schoolhouse that America was under attack. She tried to get a meeting with Andy Card to tell him what she knew, and he refused to meet with her. And then she met with John McCain after 9/11 and was telling him, look, here's what I knew. Here's what I tried to get out. You know, what's going on? A few days later, she was SWAT teamed and thrown into a military prison for 10 months. And before she was let out, she had to sign agreements not to talk about what she knew for like 5 years. So she wasn't able to talk about what she knew or write about it for 5 or 8 years. I can't remember the exact period of time, but yeah. A number of people, the CIA, though, the Mossad, all of these neocons, they all knew about 9/11 before it happened.
Yeah, when you consider that Herbert Walker was part of the CIA during the JFK assassination, long-time CIA connections, ended up being the head of the CIA.
Yeah, a lot of people believe that he was in CIA shortly after World War II. He was in charge of the Bay of Pigs, the two ships, American ships, that were used in the Bay of Pigs invasion were called the Houston and the Barbara J. Barbara J. was Barbara J. Bush, and the Houston was George Bush's hometown or where he lived at the time. So he was involved in the CIA long even before the JFK assassination.
Even though he denies it. He was lying through his eye teeth. He was deep dipped into the clandestine field. There's too many anomalies, Pat, for anybody to doubt, for Herbert Walker to be associated, closely associated, business partners with the bin Laden family.
Yeah.
How much did they pay bin Laden to trash his name and scourge the family to make him the boogeyman? That's a question that I have.
Yeah, and all this talk about, you know, bin Laden being killed during Obama's administration, the truth is everyone said on 9/11 that Bin Laden was dying from kidney failure because he had Marfan syndrome. Marfan syndrome is what a lot of people get that are extremely tall, and it affects your kidneys. But he was on dialysis before 9/11. So you're not going to have some guy, you know, planning 9/11, living in a cave in northern Afghanistan when you've got to be on dialysis for your failing kidneys. So everything we were told about 9/11 was a lie.
Everything was to draw attention away from the real perpetrators. And you've done a great job in this article pointing out the connections between the Mossad and Israel and moneyed Israel bankers, rich Jews, the Bush family, the neocons, John McCain, all of this inside the Beltway, the swamp, the ties are so glaringly obvious for anybody who has dared to look into it, Pat.
What about Alex Jones predicted the 9/11 attacks in detail on camera on his show in July of 2001, months before it happened? Well, how did he do that? And is that why they've gone after Alex Jones to destroy him?
Makes you wonder.
And he also came out about Sandy Hook. You know, he and Jim Fetzer, they tried to destroy Jim Fetzer too. Jim Fetzer took his case all the way to the Supreme Court, and they refused to look at his evidence. You know, he did the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. He had 12 different authors. 6 of them were PhDs. This book proves beyond any doubt that Sandy Hook was a drill and nobody died. People need to read it. You can read that book online for free if you want to know the truth. People need to check it out.
You know, the depth of this cover-up makes your head swim. You know, it's hard to put your finger on the pieces and line them up properly, but I read a book by Dr. Albert Pastore called Stranger Than Fiction. We used to offer it in the ministry, but Tex decided that 9/11 had happened so long ago, it just needed to be discontinued. But when you read that book and you paired it with Victor Thorne's book, 9/11 Evil, and I'll tell you how to get a copy of that at a break. But when you read both of those books, it painted such a tremendous expose. And without a shadow of a doubt, it points fingers at all the players. You're just left dumbfounded that more people aren't aware of this, Pat. And
well, and Victor Thorne died pretty mysteriously, I think, after he wrote 9/11 Evil. They claim he died of a heart attack while he was out running, I think it was.
Actually, his son called the ministry and said that he had committed suicide because of his mother had Alzheimer's. Yeah. So that
he found out he had Alzheimer's?
His mother had it. He was afraid of going down that road. If you've dealt with anybody with Alzheimer's, you know it's such a cruel disease. And I think
I hadn't heard that. So
yeah, Victor was afraid of ending up there. But anyway, still gone too long, Pat. And we have flown through 30 minutes, man. We got to take a break. Okay. My guest today is Pat McShay. We're discussing terrorism in America. All roads lead to Israel. This is part 2 of our program. We have to take a brief pause. When we come back, we are going to dive right back in. I want to hit Flight 93 and all the other shenanigans that were pulled on 9/11. You're listening to Power of Prophecy. Stay with us, won't you? I'll be right back. Hello, friends. Jerry Barrett back with you again. 9/11 Evil is the book the government, mainstream media, 9/11 Commission, distractors, obfuscators, deceivers, and those who want to keep a lid on 9/11 don't want you to read. It is the most dangerous book ever written about one of the most heinous acts carried out against the American people. Of course, there will be those who try to conceal, cover up, and ignore this information. Even those who claim to be part of the 9/11 truth movement itself. Yes, this data was available in different locations. A little here, a little there. But it had not been called together all in one place so convincingly, and it hits harder than anything ever written on the subject of 9/11. This book doesn't play nice, and it's not lightweight in the least. Instead, this is hardcore, heavy-duty reality. We already know why 9/11 was done, and we already know how the World Trade Center towers were destroyed. But for some reason, most everyone wants to shy away from who ultimately did 9/11. Sure, there are those who never go beyond the Bush-Cheney cabal, or those who blame it on faceless, shadowy entities like the New World Order or the Illuminati. But these individuals all belong to a massive protection racket that will do anything humanly possible to keep the finger of blame from being pointed in a certain direction. The big question is, do you have the guts to confront the truth about 9/11, or will you opt to be an ostrich with its head in the sand, refusing to accept the fact that 9/11 was not only an inside job, but also an outside job, and the actual terrorists didn't reside in Afghani caves or belong to a non-existent Nazi cult? Once you have read this book, you will never view this event in the same way again. It's 122 pages. We're only asking $18. Please add $6 shipping and handling. That will make your total $24 for 9/11 Evil. You can order your copy by phoning us toll-free in the United States and Canada at 1-800-234-9673. If you care to phone our regular line, that number is 512-263-9780. We're in the office Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Time. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. There's an ad for 9/11 Evil on the front page of powerofprophecy.com. Click on it. It will take you to our secure shopping cart. Fill in your name, address, charge card, shipping method, hit submit. We'll get it and get it coming to you. If you care to send in a check, money order, or cash, please make your check or money order payable to Power of Prophecy, and you can mail it to us here at 4819 R.O. Drive, Suite 102, Spicewood, Texas, and our zip code is 78669. Okay, and now let's return to our regular program. My guest today is Pat McShay. Pat, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Jerry.
Now, before the break, I teased that I wanted to cover Flight 93. Wasn't Flight 93 the one that allegedly crashed in the middle of Pennsylvania, out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, that's Shanksville. The official narrative of Flight 93 is that Middle Eastern terrorists hijacked a 757-200 with 45 people on board, and they fought with passengers until the plane crashed into a field. And that's pretty much the extent of what Americans know about Flight 93. They know more about the fictional movies made about Flight 93 when apparently one of the passengers contacted their wife and told them that they were going to go fight the terrorists. I don't know how they'd do that since cell phones were not in use on airplanes back then. But a Boeing 757-200 is 155 feet long. Its tail section is 45 feet tall. Wingspan is 125 feet. And they weigh up to 255,000 pounds. So they've got 200 seats. And the official story says that it crashed into a field and disappeared into about a 10 by 15 foot hole in the ground. I've got a picture of the hole in the ground in my article. People on the scene right after the crash said there was no evidence of a plane crash. There were no plane parts, no engines, no airplane seats, no luggage. And the coroner said at the scene, after he'd just been there 10 minutes, he started to leave, and somebody said, "Hey, why are you leaving?" He said, "There are no bodies. You can't make this stuff up." The American people were told this giant plane disappeared into a hole in Shanksville. What the government didn't tell the public is that George Bush had given an order to shoot Flight 93 down. A Canadian general at NORAD said that he scrambled military jets under orders from Bush to shoot down a hijacked commercial airplane. And a JAG officer, in his opening remarks of a terror suspect at his Guantanamo trial, said if they hadn't shot down Flight 93, it would have hit the dome. An FBI agent, Bill Crowley, told a news conference that we've not ruled out that Flight 93 was shot down, but it was later determined that debris and airplane parts were found miles from the so-called crash site, and people in the area were calling in reporting that pieces of an airplane were falling from the sky. One of two things happened to Flight 93. The real crash and what was left of Flight 93 were too gruesome to show the public, but more importantly, it would have proven that the plane was shot down, or Flight 93 was just a red herring to keep everybody guessing and confused about what really happened in Pennsylvania.
I want to go back to a comment you made just a minute ago about the phones. They claimed that there were phones on these planes and that these people called their loved ones because they knew they were going to die. And this was portrayed in the movie. Thankfully, Hollywood, it's mostly based on a true event, right? So these people got on the phone, they called their loved ones, and then somebody said, allegedly, "Let's roll." That became the mantra for this country. The propagandists came up with this phrase, "Let's roll," and it took off like wildfire. It went, as they say today, viral. But let's flash back to 2001 when this happened, Pat. Okay, most people didn't have personal computers until the late 90s, early 2000s, in their home. The internet was just a baby. People, if you had a cell phone, it was one of those great big bricks. There were more people had cell phones in their cars that had the great big antenna sticking out. But this was, if you want to use an analogy, this was the Stone Age for technology as far as computers go.
Yeah.
There were no phones on these planes. This is all a hoax. So if there were phone calls made, why were there only 45 people on this plane that had flown, what, out of Boston? You would think it would be packed, first and foremost. If it was going to be a big-time martyr for Allah, showing them how faithful I am to get rid of all these infidels, I'm not going to hijack a plane with 40 people on it.
Right. Most experts that I read agreed that phoning someone on the ground from a plane wasn't possible in 2001.
No. So this is all a hoax. But but people bought it, Pat. They made the movie Flight 93 a huge box office hit because people want to believe that this country's good, that we have a government that cares for us. They have bought the lie that these people care about us.
When Pentagon was as crazy a story as Flight 93. The official story is that a young pilot named Hani Hanjour took the controls of Flight 77, which was a Boeing 77-200. And they said that he executed a turn so tight that it reminded experienced air traffic controllers who observed that move of a fighter jet maneuver. and the plane circled it, made a 270-degree turn to approach the Pentagon. But the truth is, not long before 9/11, a flight instructor named Sherry Baxter took Hanja on 3 test runs during the second week of August. So right before 9/11, and he wanted to rent an airplane, and he had trouble controlling and landing the single engine Cessna. And even though he showed them that he had a federal pilot's license and showed evidence of hundreds of hours of flying experience, they refused to rent him a plane because he couldn't fly. And just 9 months before 9/11, Hanja was in Arizona training on a 737 simulator and did so poorly that instructors urged him to quit the program. And we're to believe that just a few months later, that he'd fly like a seasoned jet pilot, pulling off a maneuver that numerous seasoned commercial pilots would later try and fail to replicate that same move on a simulator. Russ Wittenberg was a former commercial pilot who flew. He actually flew 2 of the planes on 9/11 before that date. And he said that just jumping, when he jumped from a 737 to a 757, he said it took him a long time just to feel comfortable in the 757. He said there was that big a jump. And for him, he said for Hanja to jump from a Cessna that he couldn't fly worth a darn into a 757 and fly like an ace pilot was not just impossible. He said there was not even a chance in 1,000 that that's true. So it's just ridiculous.
The narrative, if you bother to break it down, it doesn't compute. I am shocked that more people haven't taken that step with the simulator, Pat, because the pilots that I've been around, talked to, I've read their books and their articles, and I've seen YouTube videos from seasoned commercial pilots. They are constantly spending time in these simulators to prepare them in case something malfunctions, something catastrophic happens in the cockpit, so that instead of thinking or having a chance to panic, they've practiced this a million times in the simulator. So now if it happens, it's old hat. I flick this switch, I turn this switch on, and I have my co-pilot radio to the nearest control tower, get us on the ground, save my passengers. Because the number one rule for every pilot that flies commercial is the lives and the safety of those they are flying. That's how serious these guys take this.
Yes. You know, something that has to be asked is, were those planes taken over electronically? And that, then you can look at a guy named Dov Zakim, who was the controller at the Pentagon under George W. Bush. He was also a dual Israeli citizen and a rabbi, and he held senior defense positions under 5 different presidents, and he also owned a company called System Planning Corporation that manufactured software equipment that remotely controlled and piloted these large planes. Most people don't believe that a passenger jet hit the Pentagon, and it was more than likely a smaller Global Hawk missile. But the truth is, they now know that no one entered the cockpit of that flight because they know it wasn't flown into the Pentagon. On November 27, 2009, Pilots for 9/11 Truth published a fact about Flight 77, which makes a conventional hijacking scenario impossible. According to flight data provided by the NTSB, the flight deck door was never opened on that flight. So the status of that door opening was checked every 5 seconds from the takeoff until the crash. And they showed that the door to the cockpit was never open. Another thing, Jamie McIntyre, CNN senior Pentagon correspondent for since 1992, was standing in front of the Pentagon on September 11th, just minutes after the alleged attack, and he was reporting back to Judy Woodruff in the studio and said, quote, from my close-up inspection, there is no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. Then you've got a filmmaker named Paul Cross, who was doing post-production work on a film in Washington, D.C. on 9/11. He heard about the terror attack and drove over to the Pentagon and viewed the site up close just hours after impact. And he said it was clear to him that the official story was a lie. The 9/11 scenario had been rehearsed as a terror exercise numerous times, and Osama bin Laden and his crew, were they supposedly privy to these exercises that NORAD was doing? There was no passenger plane wreckage. The lawn wasn't scorched. The lamppost and the fences and the construction material in the path of the jet were untouched. And Cross said, if this was a hoax, then the attack on the World Trade Center was a hoax too. And most people aren't aware that April Gallum, who worked at the Pentagon, had just come back to work for a half a day to take care of some business. She was an administrative specialist with top secret clearance with the U.S. Army, and she had gone to her office with her two-month-old son in a baby carriage. And she said when the explosion knocked her to the floor, she said she checked the baby who was still in his seat and started crawling toward the exit. And she was badly injured, spent weeks in the hospital after 9/11. She crawled out of the hole through the wall of the Pentagon that she would later learn was the alleged plane impact. She said there was no plane parts. She said it didn't, the plane wings didn't break a single window on either side of the hole. She said there was no bodies, no wing, no tail section, no engine, no bodies, nothing. And we're supposed to buy that this plane with a 125-foot wingspan folded up and disappeared into the 10-foot by 10-foot hole like a Looney Tunes cartoon of the Pentagon. It's just nonsense. I've got a picture of the hole shortly after, and people need to take a look at this hole. We're supposed to believe a giant plane with a 5-story tail section folded up into this tiny hole? The whole story is just nonsense.
I agree. You know, thinking back to the video footage from controlled media, ABC, I think the TV at the office was on ABC that morning, and they showed the replay and the jet fuel. You saw it just go black smoke, poof, and huge flames rolling out from when the plane contacted the Twin Towers. Why was there no scorched earth in Pennsylvania? Why was there no massive flames at the Pentagon? If these, the planes would have been full with thousands of gallons of jet fuel, Pat. But none of that.
Yeah, I wrote that.
Why didn't anybody talk about that on controlled media? Where's the flame pattern?
Yeah, well, that flight would have been full of fuel because it was flying from Dulles in D.C. to L.A. So, it would have been full of fuel.
Yeah.
And Gallup had no jet fuel on her body, and she said there was nothing else to indicate that a plane had crashed there. And the only smoke at the Pentagon was coming from a big metal trash bin just to the right of the hole in the Pentagon wall where they had built some kind of fire that was putting out thick black smoke. I think that someone set that as a diversion because no plane caught on fire there.
Think of the massive amounts of paperwork that has to be pushed through the Pentagon. The eruption from the explosion and all of the jet fuel and the escaping oxygen, it would have probably decimated the outer ring of the Pentagon.
Well, Jerry, that's another thing that we talked about with the Twin Towers. You're talking that section of the Pentagon had just been renovated and redone. The exterior, that was a steel and concrete exterior. So how in the world did a aluminum airplane penetrate that concrete and steel wall? It's just nonsense. And even if the front end had penetrated, those wings and that 45-foot tall tail section would have been shorn off and would have been laying outside the Pentagon. But they weren't.
If you've ever seen local news coverage or national news coverage of a horrific event where I remember the plane crash in Florida in the Everglades, there were plane pieces everywhere.
Yes.
There wasn't any in Pennsylvania. There wasn't any that fell to the ground at the Twin Towers. There wasn't any at the Pentagon. So the narrative, can you imagine what the PR machine was doing? They were working overtime to cover up all of this, to come up with garbage excuses, to persuade the American people that, what are you going to trust, your lying eyes or me? That's basically what they were saying.
Yeah, another thing real quick is, you know, the FBI later admitted that there were dozens of cameras showing every angle of that crash site. So for any naysayers, why did the government refuse to show the video of the impact of that plane? They still have it. Now, some video did get leaked, but that video shows what appears to be a missile hitting the Pentagon. I included the video of that in my article, and I also included the video of a Phantom 7 jet hitting a concrete wall. A Phantom jet is made of aluminum, and it just folded up like a cheap suit and disappeared. That's what would have happened at the Pentagon. It would not have penetrated that concrete and steel structure.
Now, you mentioned earlier about the remote control access that could have been in place on these 757s. You know, we in the first program, there are people, we talked about it, that believe that they were holograms. I am more inclined to believe that these jets were empty except for the fuel and whatever evidence they wanted to be found. They were remotely controlled to fly into the Twin Towers. I don't think anybody lost their life.
Here's the part that I don't know about that, because, you know, part of the no plane theory is that when you look at the holes in the Twin Towers after the plane hit, the holes, they measured those holes at like 60 feet. But the plane and the wings are 125 feet.
Right.
So, you know, you're talking about 60 feet of wing that didn't go into that hole, but no part of the plane fell to the ground. Not only that, again, you've got a nearly 50-foot tall tail section. Where did that tail section go?
Right. I understand. I understand the argument. And there are way too many questions and never enough answers, no matter how much digging we do, because we're stymied by national security. We are never going to get the full truth from our federal government because they can't. They can't admit that they sacrificed American citizens so that we would be persuaded into going in and going after Saddam Hussein. None of that, yeah, none of that could have happened.
Yeah, most people don't know that Donald Rumsfeld, September 10th, the day before 9/11, he held a press conference and announced that $3 trillion were missing at the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And who was the controller of the Pentagon? Israeli dual citizen Dov Zakim, the rabbi.
Yeah, I remember that.
That
was awful queer. Now, we're running almost out of time, Pat, but can you give me your conclusion of what you really believe happened and who was behind this mess?
Well, yeah. You know, I think that this was an Israeli Mossad CIA production. Every bit of it, I believe, was scripted. And the so-called terrorists were nothing but patsies and props. They were paid for a job and disappeared. There was never a hunt for bin Laden in Afghanistan. The masterminds of 9/11 were not Osama bin Laden or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They were powerful Israelis working with powerful American Zionists in league with influential American dual Israeli citizens. It's been proven that the Mossad and the CIA had prior knowledge of 9/11. When you have all the facts, you have to ask yourself, where did the Islamic terrorists fit in all this? They don't. At some point, you know, why are the American people, it's unconscionable that any American in this country still believes that Osama bin Laden and a ragtag group of hard-partying fake jihadists were behind 9/11. And in recent polls from Pew and Rasmussen, for the first time in our history, over 50% of the respondents say they no longer support Israel. And I think the fact that more people have the internet, more people got computers, they're seeing what really happened on 9/11. And 9/11 was a psyop to make people believe that Israel's battles are our battles. And, you know, the truth is Israel's enemies aren't necessarily our enemies. And, you know, YouTube has deleted most of the excellent documentaries from 9/11. Bookstores have always refused to stock the most important books about 9/11. Amazon bans every book that puts Israel or the Jews in a bad light. And pretty soon, you know, this absurd narrative will be all that people know about 9/11. Kids in high schools today are being taught that Osama bin Laden was behind 9/11. So, you know, just like the JFK assassination, just like the Oklahoma City bombing, we're being taught the fairy tale, and the truth is being kept from us.
Amen. So
we've got to remind people that 9/11, all roads lead to Israel.
Amen.
And
my question, and I ask this every time I start doing research, Pat, is the old Italian phrase, qui bono. Who benefits?
Yep.
Who benefited
yep.
from this fairy tale that as you aptly described it? Pat, thank you so much for coming on and spending a couple hours with us here at Power of Prophecy. I appreciate it so much, buddy. Thank you so much.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Gary. Thanks.
Okay, friends, that's going to take care of this week's program. My guest today has been Pat McShay. We want to thank you for tuning in and giving us an hour of your time. We greatly appreciate it. And as always, I pray you will tune in again next week at this same time. Tune in and discover the power of prophecy.